major country like the US directly buy, you know, a million plus Bitcoin in some kind of buy-in program over a period of time, it will probably make Bitcoin vastly more expensive because other countries will feel they have to do something or get left out. People who can see ahead a bit will switch over, and people will see other people switching over, and then they'll eventually react.
Is that how you see this one playing out, or do you think that we're still kind of in those four-year business type of cycles?
There's another phenomena which offsets it so that it still remains relevant so far through all the halvings, which is that more and more... So the argument is if you put 2% into Bitcoin, if it repeats what it did in the past, it could, you know, have an outsized effect on the portfolio. For a few years, the banks didn't want to hear the word Bitcoin. You know, now...
What's up, guys? Before we get started, I've realized that over 50,000 of you guys keep coming back for every single episode. And while I'm eternally grateful for you guys to keep coming back, I've realized that 79% of you guys are not subscribed. So I have one small ask before we get started. If you guys could hit that subscribe button and hit that like button to help send this interview and many more to the stratosphere, it would be greatly appreciated. All right, enough for me. Let's get into the show. Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Adam back in the house. But Adam, I've heard you on a few different podcasts recently talk about the potential of getting to $1 million of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Now, we're sitting here just over 100,000. How quickly do you think we're going to be getting up, and how quickly do you think we've been going through this entire cycle since you've been here since the beginning?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think people get impatient and they lose track of the fact that we're already, seven times up or something from, maybe seven and a half from the bear market, 15,500. And then, you know, I think at the moment there's a lot of coins that are being sold, probably by people who bought in the last bull market and didn't enjoy the bear market. You can tell a bit from the age of the coins that are moving. And so once those are, they can only sell them once. So once they finished, then I think there's a lot of positive news, positive regulations, more financial institutions offering Bitcoin related products, Bitcoin ETFs, the strategy companies, treasury companies buying Bitcoin. So, and Bitcoin market is very reflexive. So meaning that if the price starts moving rapidly, people will buy it because it's going up, you know, so the price is up because the price is up kind of phenomena. So I think it could happen, you know, you could see a sudden like, big movement. So we'll see how it works. You know, it might take this year or into next year, we don't know yet, or the year after even, right? The last cycle, you know, before the halving, there was a new all-time high quite close to the halving, which was new too, right? So mm-hmm. You could see something like that again either. So we just have to see how it works.
Yeah, so how are you viewing this as like a cycle in general? Because we did reach the all-time high like right before the halving earlier this year. And then, of course, you know, we're kind of floating around that right now. So I'm curious with these new corporations coming in, right? It's not really retail driven. It seems like it's more institutional driven. So how are you viewing this just like overall with, you know, the Bitcoin corporations, so to speak, like the Bitcoin holding companies coming in and then potentially governments now buying Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's in a way it's, you know, you can see there is individuals, but a different group of individuals. So the people that buy... that do their investments through a broker, then they will buy the ETFs. And they are, you know, presumably they're somebody with a stock portfolio, and so they're reallocating. So it's not, you know, taking some new money that they earned this month. It's selling some shares in something or selling some gold ETFs and buying Bitcoin ETFs. So of the money in the ETFs, somebody looked through the BlackRock 13F, I think it is, the filings, and saw that about 2/3 was individuals, actually. So, and I think who they are is just Americans with portfolios and some international mixed in.
Yeah, so where do you think that this new, cycle is somewhat going? Do you think that because it doesn't seem like the retail investor has really come in yet? So I'm kind of curious to hear where you think this direction is going, like not only just with the Bitcoin holding companies, but you know, are we still fairly early in this cycle? How do you see it developing over the next, you know, 6 to 12 months?
Yeah. I mean, personally, I think it's relatively early in the bull market cycle. I say that because, you know, 105, wherever we're at, is not, doesn't feel that high compared to 73 and a half, you know, before the halving. Considering all of the positive things that have happened in the Bitcoin space, you know, improved regulations, more open for business, more financial institutions offering Bitcoin products and services to their customers. And on the institutional side, I think the BlackRock made a recommendation, kind of model portfolio for a diversified portfolio, where they recommended to put 2% into Bitcoin, which is new. Now, BlackRock is, you know, very well respected by the traditional finance people, and there's a lot still. It's still early for them. Like, there's not that much institutional investment, so for BlackRock to make that recommendation is useful because they can refer to it, and you know, because they look at BlackRock as a very respected financial firm, the fact that they of all people made the recommendation helps others to adopt similar policies in their portfolios.
What if I told you you never had to sell your Bitcoin? Well, I found the solution for just that. You can borrow against it. Michael Saylor, Jack Mallers, plenty of people in the Bitcoin space have named Bitcoin as the most pristine collateral on the planet, and that's because it is. So that's why I've partnered with my friends over at Salt Lending. Now, they are a trusted partner with zero rehypothecation, no credit checks, and they can get you a loan very quickly. Now, they offer loans as low as 8.95% with 70% LTV, all exclusively for the Green Candle listeners. So in order to get this exclusive offer, you got to go to saltlending.com/green-candle to go potentially buy more Bitcoin, to do whatever you need to do with that liquidity so you don't have to sell that Bitcoin. Enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
But, you know, that kind of thing hasn't taken effect yet. It's just, you know, they make a decision or they make an announcement. It might take 6 months until they're able to implement it with, you know, all of the work behind the scenes to write guidelines and documents for their advisors that are advising their clients or their asset managers that are running their portfolios, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so I mean, I agree with you that it usually takes like kind of a slower thing, right? So it seems like we're kind of having this slow build up this cycle. You know, we had the, you know, 70, 80 range up to the 105 pretty quickly. And then, you know, now we're kind of floating 105-ish. So, you know, as these new players are coming in and, you know, as this cycle is kind of going up, do you think that this could potentially be that, you know, super cycle that everybody talks about where, you know, because we're having these, I guess, you know, the diamond hand, so to speak, the institutions, the countries that are not necessarily going to be selling off very quickly. Is that how you see this one playing out? Or do you think that we're still kind of in those 4-year business type of cycles, you know, sort of around the halving and the presidential election in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, probably there will be some halving effect because it is somewhat fundamental that, you know, if the amount of new coins suddenly drops, that has an economic effect. And, you know, the other thing is that people wonder that they think that the effects of halvings would diminish over time because it's a smaller percentage of the total coins in circulation. But there's another phenomena which offsets it so that it still remains relevant so far for all the halvings, which is that more and more coins are getting cold stored for the long term. So the percentage of, you know, new coins being mined, even though it's half in the next period, right, is still significant compared to the coins that are on exchange, not long-term cold stored. And so, you know, there are some on-chain metrics or analysis of how many coins are on exchange, and it's shrinking rapidly, right? So, you know, if that hits zero, something dramatic will happen. And some of the types of buyers now, like the treasury companies, they don't tend to sell. So, you know, their share price might fall in a bear market, but they won't sell the Bitcoin. So that, you know, So Pierre Rochard has made the interesting observation that that is maybe a bit of a shock absorber, because in a market pullback, some of the quite a bit of Bitcoin is in treasury companies, mm-hmm. and the price of the treasury company can absorb, you know, a down market without actually providing direct sell pressure on Bitcoin itself. So that's new. You know, we didn't have that in the previous cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course the ETF, you know, they've bought a lot of Bitcoins over twice the mined coins going into the ETFs. And, you know, they can sell, of course, but what was found, so Eric Bakonas, who's like a market commentator on ETFs, ETF expert in general, not just Bitcoin, had made the point that the ETFs appear to be quite sticky, so they're not selling off when the market pulls, when there's a small pullback, they hold. Okay. And so that's the kind of investor you want generally, because you know, people who buy and then panic sell if it falls 5%, they exacerbate the volatility. So, and they don't do themselves any favors either generally, because of the way Bitcoin works, right? But I think the fact is that they are, you know, they're managing a personal portfolio or with their advisor or something, and they're used to long-term thinking. So, you know, they'll make an allocation, they'll buy some, you know, healthcare stocks or technology stocks, and then they'll leave them for a few years, and then they'll tweak it once in a while. But so if they decide they're gonna take some, an allocation to Bitcoin ETFs, they probably just leave it there for 5 years or something, right? So they're also not moving. So you could think of those as probably quite cold storage equivalent in terms of their market impact. So, yeah, I think once the, you know, the backlog of people who are choosing to sell at 100,000 range are finished, there's a lot of buy pressure from the treasury companies and the ETFs. It's like 5 or 6 times the mined supply. So there's a big imbalance there, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said something interesting about the amount of coins on exchanges. I've been tracking that for like the past few months, to say the very least. And you know, there's about like 2 million. And then River just put out a study that said about 55% of Bitcoin that's in circulation right now is in cold storage. So do you think that both of those numbers, well, that the number on exchanges is going to continue to go down and the cold storage is going to go up, and that could potentially cause that supply shock where we just, you know, start running up pretty quickly?
Yeah, I think that's probably going to happen sooner or later, because we don't know, you know, exactly how many coins the people that are selling have. And people that are selling, they might change their mind, right? You know, once there's a momentum up, then they buy back in at a higher price. People do that kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. They'll panic sell when it goes down, and they'll panic buy when it goes up, and they sold and they'd realize, oh, that was not the top. Or, you know, I mean, so, you know, you're just looking at the aggregate behavior of people's market psychology of, you know, where they bought. You know, I think it takes people a cycle or two to come around to the idea that it's probably better just to buy and hold.
Yeah.
And cold store. So there are, you know, you have relatively new people, like maybe in the last couple of years, who are probably, you know, trying to profit take, or thinking that, you know, they've booked a profit now, they bought at 50,000, 60,000, they booked a profit, and they're scared it would go away again.
Mm-hmm.
So they're part of the picture that's holding it back from going higher. Because I think the fundamentals are there for Bitcoin to be a lot higher at this point.
Yeah. And I'm curious how you view, because we've touched a little bit on the institutions and that aspect, but it seems like the new wave is a lot of these lending products as well. So do you think that on top of everything too, I mean, of course that's not in cold storage, but it's not necessarily needing to sell your Bitcoin for some sort of liquidity, right? I mean, yeah. Jack talks about the hodler's dilemma, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is a phenomenon that as Bitcoin becomes more flexibly combined with personal finances and the kinds of loans that people take to manage their, you know, what they're doing in terms of like a car loan, auto loan, or a mortgage, there are starting to be interesting mortgage products on the market. So there's a couple of them. There's a Newmarket Battery, which is a Bitcoin collateralized, well, it's primarily a property collateralized loan, you know, the real estate itself, plus a bit of Bitcoin extra collateral, which makes it much safer for the borrower because, you know, they can withstand a major Bitcoin fall down without any, you know, margin call or liquidation risk. And Milo is another firm doing that. And so, you know, the availability of products like that, it's kind of equity release. So it means that somebody who might have otherwise sold some Bitcoin doesn't, and they prefer not to, actually. So it's kind of win-win in the sense that, you know, if a number of people use those kind of products instead of selling, then they're not impacting the market by selling. And that's what they want too, right? So it allows them to continue to be in the market with that part of their coins to benefit from, you know, the next 4 years of price, you know, of adoption and price appreciation. Yeah.
Spectre. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that that would be kind of the next wave, it seems, right? So like the institution and the retail investor, instead of them having to sell now, they can potentially borrow against that.
I mean, we were saying there's like, we're onto the third wave, and like the first wave being people who bought on exchange, second wave being people who bought through the ETFs, and the third wave being institutions. But actually, this is an additional factor, the availability of smart structured credit, because I think just directly borrowing against Bitcoin to buy something illiquid like real estate, a house, a flat, is a little risky, because you know if it can drop 80%, you can't sell a house or part sell a house to pay it back, right? So these kinds of structured finance where you are mostly borrowing against the house and then there's a bit of over collateral with Bitcoin, and I think by doing it in a clever way, they can reduce even the deposit you need. You know, maybe you don't need much deposit or even any deposit if you're, you know, wanted to take the trade off, right? So those are very interesting tools, and that you're seeing the early stages of Bitcoin being sort of becoming part of the financial landscape, you know, delivering new value to Bitcoin holders and ultimately to everybody.
This bull run, I'm looking for ways to stack Bitcoin in my sleep, and mining has always caught my eye. I've partnered with the guys over at Simple Mining to help you do just that. I don't recommend anything that I don't use personally, so I've got a machine up and running with them right this second. And they've even opened the facility up so anyone can go and visit. They manage over 15,000 machines for 500 clients, handling all of the maintenance and repairs so you don't have to. And for the Green Candle listeners, they're giving an exclusive offer: all the repairs for the first year for free. So if you've been thinking about mining, head on over to simplemining.io/greencandle to get this exclusive offer and learn about the potential tax benefits that you can get from mining with Simple Mining. All right, enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
I think you might see even some financial products that start to make sense for somebody who's not a Bitcoiner. That, you know, if the mortgage that is combined with Bitcoin is maybe a better mortgage. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're new to Bitcoin, you don't have any Bitcoin, and you talk to one of these providers, maybe it's a more interesting mortgage. You get some Bitcoin upside, get something more attractive about the type of loan. You know, that could be interesting too, right? But I think that's also early. I think that not much money has been placed in it. But I think that is a multi-billion demand, actually. Because, you know, a lot of people in Bitcoin, it's hard for them to get a mortgage because the banks don't understand Bitcoin, or some of them are, you know, self-employed or like contract workers or something. And so the mortgage companies are very rigid in their form of what they want to see to give a mortgage, right? So if you travel a lot, if you work remotely, if you live in a different country to your passport, or if you're a contract worker, it's hard to get a mortgage. Or just living in a different country, it's hard to get a mortgage.
Yeah. Yeah, and banks don't usually like to use like Bitcoin as some of your assets or anything. And you know, a lot of Bitcoiners don't even really want to disclose how much Bitcoin that they have. If it's not on an exchange or something like that, you know, it leads to a lot of hairiness, to say the very least. Yeah. But it seems like Bitcoin is starting to take over various industries, right? So we're talking about potentially the real estate market. Wells Fargo actually wrote an article here fairly recently talking about Bitcoin taking over the bond market and citing MicroStrategy or Strategy with Michael Saylor, with Strive, Stride, and all of these other products that they're rolling out, it seems like, every single month. So do you think that Bitcoin is essentially going to, you know, take over every single financial market? And, you know, how do you see it, I guess, almost taking over the bond market?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a huge arbitrage. So you've got the current fiat world, and you've got the future Bitcoinized world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Hal Finney had his famous $200 trillion addressable market. I think that it seems to be about in the right range, and maybe it's a bit more now because of the inflation. Mm-hmm. And so you could view a lot of these trades, like the treasury company phenomena, as, you know, using this arbitrage to, you know, bring forward buying Bitcoin. And of course, their actions are also closing the gap, right? Their pressure on the Bitcoin supply, their pressure on the Bitcoin price. And so I think, you know, all of these things are basically, you know, dragging the world of finance to a Bitcoin future, because it has such fundamental advantages that you can't really fight it. I mean, mm-hmm. you can fight it, but it's going to hurt you economically. So effectively, you know, people who can see ahead a bit will switch over, and, you know, other people will see other people switching over, and then they'll eventually react. So I think you got some of the makings of hyper-Bitcoinization here. So we don't know how long it will take, but it's a very big arbitrage. So,
yeah. Yeah, we were saying earlier that it doesn't seem like, you know, the traditional financial advisor maybe in the United States isn't there yet. Yeah. And it seems like banks are just starting to talk about it. Like, we've had Jamie Dimon essentially, you know, hating on Bitcoin publicly for, you know, almost a decade now. Yeah. And now he's finally saying that they can they'll offer Bitcoinized products, whether it's the ETF or something, and then you could also get a loan against it. Yeah. How big do you think that is for the adoption? Do you not think that is, you know, anything that is, you know, I guess, needed for Bitcoin to continue to do what it does?
Well, I mean, I think you can see that, you know, it's hard to argue against Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin tends to win.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, there was Vanguard, famously, is like a big financial institution in the U.S. Mm-hmm. with investment clients. They famously said that they were not enabling any Bitcoin products on their platform and discourage it. And then the CEO got turned over, right? They just put a new CEO. So maybe they'll come around afterwards. And Jamie Dimon, as you said, he's been, you know, saying negative things about Bitcoin from his personal view, but even he was forced to capitulate. Because, you know, they have investment clients, and the investment clients are saying, I want this, and if you don't give it to me, I'm going to go to your competitor, right? Yeah. So he has to change. So, you know, and I think maybe there's some generational things. Some of these guys are pretty old guys who've been in a you know, big bank for decades, right? So maybe they'll never get there. But the next CEO, when they retire, will, you know, be more in tune with the current world of Bitcoin capital. So I think these are all, like, potentially huge markets, actually, and it's all pulling in one direction. So I think it's like the arbitrage of the century, really, because it's a kind of, you know, once in hundreds of years kind of event where something completely changes about a whole basis of finance and capital.
Yeah, and it seems like it's revolutionizing finance, to say the very least. And, you know, I'm curious kind of what your role you think, you know, the banking system takes in this, because obviously, you know, Bitcoin has it, be your own bank, cold storage, all that. You know, some banks have said they'll start to offer custody for Bitcoin. You know, we have Caitlin Long with Custodia Bank, who's, you know, trying to revolutionize the banking system. But it seems like banks and traditional financial advisors previously, before the ETFs, had no incentive to really understand Bitcoin. And now, like you said, they're essentially being forced. Yep. So, you know, with the bending of the knee that's occurring with all of these guys, Do you think that this is going to be like kind of another wave, right, where we're having the Bitcoin-backed companies? So now they're all having their, you know, the media is covering it every single day, it seems. And then, you know, we have the loan products on it. So now the banks are essentially going to have to compete with these products popping up and, you know, potentially looking at investing in these companies. So now they're just forced to learn about Bitcoin. Do you think that that's kind of what's going on? Or do you think, you know, they're still, I guess, like resistant and they're just, it's a very slow moving industry?
I mean, you can see that some of them are resisting, like Vanguard and JP Morgan. He's capitulated, evidently.
Yeah.
But there were also some friction in a previous administration in the U.S. where the regulators were making it difficult for banks to provide Bitcoin services based on, I mean, one was providing banking service to Bitcoin-related companies, so they needed approval from the regulator and they weren't giving it. And so that has been repealed with SAB 121. I think mm-hmm. they don't need the approval, they can provide a service. So that's opened up some things. And the other is that in some countries, and it's not just the US, they need to have sort of capital reserve requirements. So in order to custody Bitcoin in the bank, they have to hold on to an enormous amount of cash. And they lose money because, you know, each million of cash they have, they can project how much they can make with it by, you know, providing mortgage financing, by providing, you know, investment banking finance to companies, so all kinds of types of finance. And so if they provide a Bitcoin service, it was punitively expensive. So they would have to charge, you know, very high management fee on an ETF, like 3.5% annual, just to make it break even, just to make it worthwhile, right? And so as the banks are working around that, by, you know, doing their custody in a different country or working out some solution, or the regulators are dropping that excessive capital requirement, because Bitcoin is, you know, it's collateral in itself. It's mm-hmm. it's hard money, right? So you don't really need a capital reserve requirement, but nevertheless, the regulator treated it so that, you know, if something went wrong, the bank was supposed to have lots of money left to buy replacement Bitcoin or something like that, right? So that, you know, that has also been improved in the US. So now it's possible for the big custodians who normally custody shares. So if you have a brokerage in the US, the shares are actually held by a custodian. And it's the same in Europe or anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so now they are enabled by the regulations to do that custody. And those are the type of custodians that the other banks would normally use, actually. So a lot of the friction is going away. And I think the banks are seeing dollar signs. Like, you know, there's appetite for this type of product. Mm-hmm. Their competitors are doing it, and they're in business to make money. So they're gonna get there. Now, you know, some of the characters in the bank management might have things to say on TV or news, financial news, and so on. But the financial incentive is there to embrace it and, you know, race to take to get that type of business into their banks.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems that's the way, right? It's like dollar signs, right? Money talks at the end of the day. But how quickly do you think that this is moving? You know, when, you know, you've obviously been here since before the beginning, you know, named in the white paper and everything. But it seems like in the 15-year period, so much has happened in Bitcoin, especially just in the past like couple months. So did you think we were going to get here, or do you think we're not even moving very quickly right as it stands right now?
Well, I think it's interesting because over the longer term, things have moved much quicker and gone to places that, you know, people never thought would happen, or not for decades, and they're here, right? You know, mm-hmm. like the idea that the you know, there'll be a sovereign wealth fund or a government holding Bitcoin. People didn't expect that, right? I mean, they wouldn't even expected public market companies to be holding Bitcoin or banks to be vying for providing services, you know, related to Bitcoin or products related to Bitcoin. And, you know, my company Blockstream, we founded that in 2014. And at that time, and for a few years, the banks didn't want to hear the word Bitcoin. They, you know, they weren't interested in blockchain. They didn't want to hear about Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. After a couple of years, they all realized that, you know, the blockchain technology could be disruptive. It could be a new settlement network, a new technology for transferring value, shares and money and so on. And so they, all of the major banks had blockchain R&D labs, but they didn't want to hear the word Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now it's, you know, so that was blockchain, not Bitcoin, but now it's Bitcoin, not blockchain. You know, they just want to rush to provide products and services for investment clients and retail banking clients around Bitcoin, because that's where their money is. So it's kind of come through a full cycle. And I think it has, you know, I think we get impatient because we see the news that such and such a brokerage or financial institution is diving into Bitcoin. And you know, you wonder, well, why is the price not higher? Oh, I think it's because it takes them months and months to do the processes to start delivering those products and services. And so it feels slow at the time because the financial effects are lagging the news. But if you zoom out, it's actually accelerated. Like, it's happened, you know, twice as fast as anybody thought, you know, that there'd be a government. And now even the US government, you know, the different states within the US are trying to get approvals. And some of them have approvals now in hand to acquire Bitcoin in the state treasuries, so mm-hmm. the state's own cash reserves. And the main federal US government is also, you know, working on some kind of Bitcoin treasury, which, you know, at a minimum would be not selling any seized, you know, proceeds of crime seized coins they have. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are proposals that they could buy 1 million. Now, personally, I'm more interested in the individual buying Bitcoin than in governments buying Bitcoin. And, you know, if they do, you know, if a major country like the US does, like, directly buy, you know, 1 million plus Bitcoin in some kind of buy-in program over a period of time, it will probably make Bitcoin vastly more expensive because other countries will feel they have to do something or get left out. The fear of missing out applies to individuals, companies, and countries ultimately, right? So, you know, as the saying is, everybody buys Bitcoin at the price they deserve or something like this, right? Mm-hmm. Then I think the governments deserve to pay a lot more. So I would sooner they didn't rush that. And, you know, some of the types of buying that are happening are not directly by individuals, but by fund managers are still on behalf of individuals. So you see, you know, like a pension fund buying Bitcoin, and at Blockstream we recruited a hedge fund manager who also ran a pension fund for some years, and he was the first public pension plan to get Bitcoin onto the balance sheet. This was in 2021. So you can see that a pension fund like that with Bitcoin, that is for the benefit of the, you know, the workers that are using that pension fund, and that was transport workers in Santa Clara. So as more pension funds buy Bitcoin, it's actually beneficial to the average person who is not managing, you know, not managing a brokerage account or doing custom investments. And there are other things like that, you know, life insurance policies, mutual funds that maybe people are doing recurring savings through. So if the professional fund managers catch up with Bitcoin, start looking at it in the same way that BlackRock is proposing. Coincidentally, Sean Bill, our CIO with the pension fund experience, had proposed a 1-3% allocation, which is in the same region as BlackRock has said now, you know, quite a few years later, because he started in 2019. Mm-hmm. Took him a couple of years to get it in. So, you know, he said it, you know, 5 years before, actually, but the same range. And the logic there is just that pension funds are very conservative, so they don't like to experience a big drop. So they'll invest in shares, but they don't want something that could drop much more than that. And they control the risk by diversifying and balancing things. And so the argument is, if you put 2% into Bitcoin, even if it drops 50%, it's only a 1% hit on a portfolio. Mm-hmm. And they can tolerate that. And yet, if it repeats what it did in the past, it could, you know, have an outsized effect on a portfolio. So I think that pension fund bought Bitcoin at 17,000. So you can see that they're already, you know, five, six times up on that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so not too bad of an investment right at that time. So I think, you know, as we're starting to see more of these governments and everything else start to come on, I'm curious to, I guess, hear your thought on, you know, more. I know you think that, you know, the governments, they need to have the Bitcoin at the price that they're, or they're going to have the Bitcoin at the price that they deserve, right? But, you know, how do you think the market dynamics are going to shift if the United States announces, hey, you know what, we're going to follow the Cynthia Lummis bill? We're basically telling everybody we're going to buy 1 million coins, 200,000 a year for 5 years, and then hold for 20 years.
Yeah.
I feel like once you just kind of divulge your plan like that, that's when the market is going to go crazy.
Right.
So on the flip side of that, I think the money makers are, you know, the big hedge funds, like you said, with the volatility, they're worried that, you know, when a Bitcoin is going up and down super volatile, they want to put a small percentage in there. But the narrative right now is that as more of these big players come in, as the market cap increases, Bitcoin's going to get less volatile. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side, there's more money coming in. So how do you think the market is going to develop?
Okay, so you've discovered Bitcoin and are on the path to financial self-sovereignty, but simply holding Bitcoin is not enough. You need to make sure that it's stored properly and you are in 100% control over all your assets. So sharing your keys with third parties and taking on that counterparty risk is not the answer. The answer is pure and simple. It's uncompromising self-custody, and there's no better way to do it than the Bitcoin way. They've got over 25 years of cybersecurity experience, and their team of experts can help you properly self-custody your Bitcoin, secure your digital life, configure your privacy phones, and even establish a Plan B residency if you're looking to do so. So I'm gonna help you guys out here and give you a free consultation if you take the first step and visit thebitcoinway.com/greencandle, and you can check out the boys at The Bitcoin Way and see how they can help you become self-sovereign.
Do you think we're still going to have this volatility? Or do you think we're going to kind of level off here and just kind of slowly creep up?
I mean, I think it's dropping a bit, but not, you know, it's still significant volatility because it's, I think it's somewhat inevitable that if something is undergoing rapid adoption, it's going to overshoot. You know, people will get enthusiastic, they'll bid the price up, mm-hmm. and then some people will take a profit. So there's too much like momentum and uncertainty, and the uncertainty causes the volatility. So I think you continue to see it, but the new types of investors buying Bitcoin, like the ETF buyers, the treasury company buyers are, you know, the treasury company don't sell unless they really mess up, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's something they really don't want to do for like marketing reasons. And the ETF buyers also, you know, quite long-term holder outlook. So the fact that that kind of money is in there is helping reduce the volatility going forwards. And also the Bitcoin, you know, the first wave investors, if they've been in market for a long time, they get more conviction, they get more all in, or the price goes up so that what they had is less percentage, so they're almost all in by accident, right?
Yeah.
Then it's hard for them to buy the dip. Like if Bitcoin price pulls back, most of the Bitcoin holders would like to buy more, but they're out of money, right? And so that makes the volatility bad because there's not much capital to buy, you know, to do the value investor thing. And if something falls that you have a long-term belief in, you buy more, right? So now, with some of these new investors, they are in a position to buy more because it's part of a portfolio. So they could sell something else. They could sell some Tesla stock, some Apple stock, whatever else they have in the portfolio. If they see an opportunity that Bitcoin is temporarily pulled back by 20, 30%, they can say, great, I'll sell some other stuff and buy Bitcoin. It's got more alpha. It's got going more places. And that in itself reduces the volatility, right? Because you've got more ammunition, more firepower to buy in a market, to buy a pullback, so that will tend to reduce the pullback. But yeah, I mean, on the government side, I really think that the market doesn't believe that they're going to buy it, then they're going to do the Lummis bill. Otherwise, the price would already be a lot higher. Mm-hmm. And if they do announce that, and you know, they're still actively working on a plan, right? So it's not that, you know, they're not trying.
Yeah.
It's just kind of complicated. And of course, you know, it's very hard for a government to do what a hedge fund might do, which is to quietly buy the Bitcoin and then announce it later.
Yeah, like a
they can't. They have to like disclose it, right? And it has to go through different parts of government approval processes. So as soon as it's clear that they're actually going to do it, as I said, I don't think the market believes it yet, then I think that will cause other governments to copy. And then, you know, everybody will see what's happening. So they'll get fear of missing out and they'll bid the price up. So it'll be hard for the governments to even buy at this price, right? Because as soon as they announce they started, price is already front run, bid up ahead by the open market, right?
Yeah.
On the news.
Do you think that there's the potential of governments already buying and just being quiet about it? Or
I mean, I think some of the sovereign wealth funds could be. Because, you know, they do make disclosures, but, you know, they're not all in the US. So, like, the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund bought $450 million of Bitcoin a while ago. But, you know, there are other funds, and maybe they have other pockets that bought without talking about it. Maybe there are other sovereign funds in other countries that have bought quietly because they don't want to, you know, get the publicity.
Yeah.
You know, if there's the political cover that other countries are doing it, they might disclose, oh, yeah, we bought a few years ago, right? So that could be good for them. Another kind of indirect buyer is the Swiss National Bank. They have 1% of their US stock exposure in MicroStrategy, so they've got proxy. And the Swiss National Bank is not a sovereign wealth fund, but it could be in terms of what it does. It's like a successful hedge fund. They buy a lot of equities mm-hmm. and other types of investment.
Yeah. I think the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund is like, it's the biggest in the world, and they hold a significant amount of MicroStrategy as well. So mm-hmm. I think like all these sovereign wealth funds around the world are slowly starting to get in. But I'm curious if you think that there's going to be a wave of, you know, countries trying to utilize Bitcoin mining and, you know, kind of use that aspect of Bitcoin to not only get exposure, but, you know, utilize some excess energy and kind of go attack it that way instead of necessarily outwardly saying, hey, we're going to go and buy millions or billions of dollars worth of Bitcoin.
I mean, it's definitely something they could do. And Blockstream's first, we do some mining. We mm-hmm. used to do some mining. We still have mining, but it's in a separate company. We spun it out. And the first location we did mining was in Canada. Mm-hmm. And Canada, it's different by region, but the Quebec region, the province, has 65 hydro dams. So the grid power is hydro, almost mm-hmm. you know 99-something%, right? And they had a lot of it. So when we were mining in 2015, I calculated that they had so much unused power capacity that province of Canada could have mined the whole Bitcoin network at enough
My
power.
God.
Now, of course, the network's bigger now, so that's probably not the case anymore. But they don't seem to be making use of it. Like they were holding back miners from expansion, so we actually expanded in the US instead, in Texas mostly. And but you know, that power company is a state owned, there's a crown corporation, which means owned by the government. And so, you know, if they were to take a view like the US is in terms of building a sovereign reserve, they could really use the excess hydropower and build up a reserve that way. It would cost them almost nothing because it's unused capacity. They're not getting any money for it anyway, right? Because they have to buy the miners. But if you're mining with free power, you can do pretty well mining.
Yeah.
And so, I think it's interesting because you can draw some analogies with previous events in older history where, you know, there was kind of global expansion looking for gold and, you know, actually some wars trying to take the gold from gold-rich locations in the world. And then, you know, discovery of black gold, like oil, petroleum products, that made some countries wealthy and powerful who weren't before. And, you know, of course, once they realized they had the reserves, they could, you know, invest in developing that and extracting it and benefiting from it as a country. And so you've got, and you know, with digital gold, you got a new opportunity like that, which is if you have the energy resources, that's, you know, you don't have to have a, you know, gold ore in the ground, you don't have to have oil reserves under the ground, but if you've got cheap, abundant power, that's a natural resource, and you can, you know, change, you know, mining with that intensively as soon as possible. Now, the one difference with it is that with gold or with oil, you can extract it today, or you can extract it in, you know, 30 years, 50 years, it's still there, right? Mm-hmm. With Bitcoin, you got to do it now. Because, you know, the same energy reserves will mine a lot more Bitcoin today than it will in 5 years.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to see people. It's yet another example of we're still early, right? They're sitting on a vastly valuable natural resource that is eroding rapidly. You know, if you don't use the power today, it's going to be less effective in the future. And it's wasted. They're not even using it. And they are doing nothing, right? So a few countries have stepped up. El Salvador, Bhutan, mm-hmm. maybe a few others quietly, but it's I think it's a kind of new wave, so it could be a way for them to tactically use natural resources. Yeah.
The best place to buy Bitcoin in the United States and Canada is the Bitcoin Well. You could go to thebitcoinwell.com/greencandle and sign up today, and they will give you wishing well tokens. They are one of the only exchanges in the United States that will give you free sats every time you buy Bitcoin. You have a chance to win 1 million sats every time you buy. You get wishing well tokens, you flip the coin down the wishing well, and you have the chance to win 1 million sats. You heard me here, folks, 1 million sats. And on top of that, they have the absolute best over-the-counter service where you can make purchases over $50,000, and they will walk you through the whole thing. They have the best rates in the United States and in Canada. And on top of that, they have the best white glove service where they will take you through those giant purchases just so you feel comfortable. You'll get it in cold storage, and it's strictly non-custodial. They are saying, we want you to experience the true power of Bitcoin, and that's self-custody. So go to the well, sign up, bitcoinwell.com/greencandle today. Enough for me, back to the show.
Do you think that's potentially the way, you know, because in the US, they're talking about, hey, using like not using taxpayer dollars to buy Bitcoin. Do you think that that's potentially a way that the US is going to be moving forward with this? Or are they looking at it more from just like a financial base side? Because it seems like, you know, they've got Howard Lubnick, they've got Bo Hines, they both have kind of more of the financial background and maybe not the energy background. So maybe they're not looking at it from that perspective. Although Trump has also said drill, baby, drill. So,
yeah. I mean, I think Texas is probably a little bit more energy focused because it's like, you know, an oil extraction state and they have a lot of energy production there. And actually, the Texas part of the US grid is lower cost and more deregulated than mm-hmm. other parts of the country. So I think that the, you know, the new, this sort of tax neutrality of buying Bitcoin is maybe more of a political popularity thing that, you know, if they increase the taxes and they buy Bitcoin, there'll be argument. So mm-hmm. they're trying to find a way to say that they did it with a balance. You know, they didn't change the budget. You know, they stopped doing something else and they used that money for buying Bitcoin instead, or sell some other asset, like sell some gold, let's say. Maybe a simple way to do it, right?
Yeah.
Sell, you know, some many tons of gold and buy some Bitcoin. Seems like a good idea, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it seems like it's an obvious idea at this point. And it's actually interesting because River came out with a study and said more Americans today own some sort of Bitcoin, whether it's like, you know, the ETFs or the mm-hmm. physical cold storage, than any type of gold, whether it's paper gold, you know, or actually gold bars in the basement. I mean, I don't know how they would know the gold bars in the basement aspect, but
I saw Van Eck. So the firm is the fellow who started the firm is Mr. Van Eck. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Van Eck,
yeah,
on a financial news a few days ago, saying something similar, which is that he was saying that 30 million Americans own gold and 50 million own Bitcoin, something like that. So mm-hmm. it sounds like a similar statistic. I mean, they must have to. Presumably, it includes indirect, like, you know, if you own some MicroStrategy, you own some Bitcoin, et cetera, right? So maybe there are some, like, mutual funds that have a bit of MicroStrategy in them. So it might be a little bit, you know, there might be people who own Bitcoin who don't realize they own Bitcoin, but still they're exposed to Bitcoin in some percentage, right? But yeah, I mean, I guess you just have to use best effort with public information to put a ballpark.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't even think like majority of people realize that if you own any part of the S&P 500, Tesla holds Bitcoin on their balance sheet. So you have some sort of exposure. But majority of people, especially even in the Bitcoin space, don't think of Tesla as like a Bitcoin holding company or anything.
Right.
Because of just Elon's relationship and Elon's stardom and everything like that. But seemingly everybody in the United States, you know, through retirement funds or everything, has some sort of relative exposure to Bitcoin at this point.
Yeah.
So I think that, that market's going to be continuing to, you know, develop and go up, basically. But as these corporations are coming on, I guess, like, where's the stop? Or is there any sort of worry that you have with these financial-based products kind of coming on to Bitcoin? Because it seems like it's moving very quick. And, you know, we also had that blow up. Obviously, everything's good for Bitcoin in the end. But, you know, 2017, 18 with, you know, BlockFi, Celsius, all of these lending products that came out then. It seems like now the new wave is not only like the lending products from a personal like side of things, but more of like the institutions and the Bitcoin holding companies.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got to be careful where risks lie. And that was the, you know, that was what went wrong ultimately with BlockFi, FTX, Poly, Genesis, Gemini Earn, Voyager, which is a Canadian public company, Celsius. So a lot of contagion where, you know, one trade would go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And other people were exposed to that trade, so then they went bankrupt, and then somebody else was exposed to them, so they went bankrupt, and so it caused a lot of economic damage in the system, and probably was a non-trivial part of causing the market correction, actually. And if you try to unpack what was under it, it was really that there was some high-risk activity that was not, you know, that's misunderstood, or advertised as a lot safer than it was. And so that was ultimately the GBTC op trade that Three Arrows Capital and others were doing. So it's just that there's a GBTC is now an ETF, and Grayscale actually were quite useful in helping the industry by suing the SEC at the time, the mm-hmm. previous administration, to get approval for the ETF. And so all the other ETFs were able to benefit from that. But before the ETF, they had GBTC was a closed-ended fund, so you could put Bitcoin in, or put money in, but you couldn't take it out. You could only sell into the market, and because it was the only product, it ended up commanding a premium. You know, so it would trade 20%, 30%, 40% above a peak, the intrinsic value of the Bitcoin. And it's not like a strategy company where it's doing something; it's just holding Bitcoin, right? So there's only for like tax advantage or.
Yeah.
You know, accessibility. And so what Three Arrows Capital did, the arb trade, is you buy or borrow Bitcoin, you pay it into the fund, there's a lockup period, which was 12 months, they reduced it to 6, and then you can sell the fund units. So if there's a 20% premium, you make 20% on a Bitcoin in 6 months, and then you keep doing it. And so they thought this was a good trade, and they applied a lot of leverage to it. And Genesis, which is part of Digital Currency Group that Grayscale is in, lent Three Arrows Capital a lot of money to do more of it. And then, of course, eventually, it's a closed-ended fund. You've got a bear market, premium went negative. Three Arrows Capital became very, very bankrupt. And it turned out that the Bitcoin they had borrowed was not collateralized. So, you know, that caused other bankruptcies. That's the start of it. But, you know, you could see one hint that something was not good in that picture was that the companies downstream are offering interest on Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And if the interest rate's high, it's not really easy to explain why they're able to offer such a high interest. There's some risk being, you know, concealed or misunderstood. And I think that's the hallmark. So I think the lower risk Bitcoin yields is maybe only 2-4%. So when you see people offering 7, 8, 9, 10% competing with each other, there's some risk there. You know, there's some Ponzi, or there's some risk, or there's some altcoin stuff, there's some DeFi stuff, something with technical risk, or, you know, there are all kinds of gamified Ponzi's inside the DeFi space. So, you know, some of that might have been in there too.
Yeah, and it seems like the new development as well, there's a lot of announcements on the potential of like Lightning yield. Now, is that different than the potential yield that was essentially the Ponzi risk that we were talking about before? Or is there still some of that risk that you kind of foresee with a lot of these new products coming out from that?
No, I mean, I think that there is some utility from providing liquidity to Lightning. Uh-huh. So Lightning Network has, what, like 4,500 Bitcoin of liquidity in it. And in order for the Lightning Network to work smoothly, it needs more Bitcoin in it as the usage grows. And, you know, the companies that operate in that won't necessarily have enough Bitcoin themselves. And so they want to borrow Bitcoin to put into Lightning. So, you know, of course, you have to be a bit careful about trust and security. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, there is a return to be made from collecting routing fees on liquidity in Lightning. So that is one factor. Another type of sort of natural Bitcoin liquidity is lending in liquid. You know, so there is a way to trade MicroStrategy, Metaplanet, and some more of the treasury companies in the future, where you are trading against Bitcoin. So it's, you know, you've got 100 MicroStrategy shares in a fund unit that's a token, a security token, and it's priced in Bitcoin. And so, you know, you would be buying it with Bitcoin when you think it's cheap, when the MNAV is low, and you'd be selling it for Bitcoin when you think the MNAV is higher. And so if people want to apply leverage to that trade, because it's a Bitcoin basis trade, mm-hmm. they could usefully borrow Bitcoin, but it's, you know, a relatively safe form of borrowing because it'd be over collateralized with, you know, with stock, basically, with MicroStrategy stock, let's say. So you're seeing, because more of the financial market is moving to a Bitcoin basis, you know, treasury company is, you know, recognizing this, that Bitcoin is the hurdle rate, mm-hmm. that, you know, if you are trying to provide investment products and you can't outperform Bitcoin, then people shouldn't invest. They should just buy Bitcoin, right? Excuse me. I may get a drink.
Yeah, you need some water?
Yeah. You want a juice?
We've got like 10 more minutes, so I was just going to ask you like maybe one or two more questions. So yeah, we're almost done.
Yeah, I was thinking because I wasn't looking at the clock.
Yeah, that's why I got the phone here so I could check.
You got it figured out, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this is all kind of very interesting the way we're seeing this, the financial markets develop. One thing that they're talking about kind of similarly is that potentially making the ETFs in kind. So like you deposit Bitcoin, then you get Bitcoin out potentially over time. And then, you know, there's always been this rumor of paper Bitcoin with the ETFs. Mm. Now, is that something that you think that these ETFs should start offering just so, you know, we're avoiding any potential downfalls with that down the line?
I mean, I think that there are two types of in-kind. So one is something technical, so which won't be experienced by the user, but makes them a little bit more efficient in terms of the cost of you know, how close the price of the ETF tracks the Bitcoin price. And that is that there are kind of arbitrage companies called authorized participants who are allowed to arbitrage the ETF price against the spot Bitcoin price. And so if they see the ETF is a bit cheaper, they're allowed to buy it, rip it apart, and sell the Bitcoin. So they kind of burn it effectively. And if they think the ETF's a bit expensive, they can do the opposite, which is they can create Bitcoin. Create ETF units, mm-hmm. and then go and buy Bitcoin on the spot exchanges and deliver it. And so the in-kind is about the mechanism the authorized participants use to pay the ETF provider. So they're artificially forced by lack of in-kind to send them a wire transfer, and then they're going to buy the Bitcoin. So it's kind of inefficient and illogical because, you know, it means that the authorized participants have to hedge the Bitcoin price. You have to buy like a future or something, or buy Bitcoin. Then they need some credit to send a wire transfer. Then the ETF provider is going to buy the Bitcoin, and then they're going to close the hedge so they don't lose money, right? Uh-huh. So that all that extra process is it's increasing the inefficiency a little bit. So the first type of in-kind they're talking about is just stop that nonsense, and the authorized participant will buy the Bitcoin and transfer it to the ETF, and it'll be done, right? So it's just simple, much simpler. Now they are pretty efficient because they've, you know, they're working hard and they're big and they're competing. There are multiple participants competing. Mm-hmm. But then what you're talking about is another kind, which is the ability to take some existing Bitcoin and sort of pay it into the ETF so that you don't suffer a tax hit if you sell Bitcoin to buy a wrapped Bitcoin, right? That's a kind of, mm-hmm. so you really don't want to pay a tax just because you're, you know, storing it in a different way, right? So I think that would be useful as well. And maybe you can do it without tax anyway. I don't know, but it's inefficient in a lot of ways to the way it works now. So yeah.
Yeah, you talked about taxes, and I think that's an interesting thing that we're starting to see too. Is like a lot of countries are starting to eliminate capital gains tax if you hodl Bitcoin for 5 years or longer, and some are just starting to get rid of capital gains altogether. How long do you think we're going to, or do you ever think we're going to get to a place where we're never going to tax Bitcoin and it's going to kind of avoid that? And do you think it's going to kind of change the way that they're looking at taxation?
I mean, it's internationally, there's tax competition. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it's, in Europe, it's quite easy for somebody with a European passport to move to another European country. And there are big differences. And it's not just, you know, tax havens like Malta that have, you know, don't have the capital gain. Like Germany, for example, I think if you hold Bitcoin for a couple of years, there's no tax, mm-hmm. no capital gains tax. So it really depends per country. And some countries have, you know, made it difficult. So the UK, you know, most countries have some kind of tax-free savings plan for retirement. In the UK, they have something called an ISA, mm-hmm. and you can put shares into it, but you can't put Bitcoin into it. And the FCA wouldn't allow people to buy Bitcoin ETFs for, you know, for their own protection, right? Let's say. Uh-huh. And so I think what people in the UK were doing, I hear this from some British residents, that they'd buy MicroStrategy and they put that in ETF, put that in the ISA. Japan has something similar, right? Which is that the tax, it's a tax issue there, which is if you, the tax rate on share capital gains, so I think 20%, but the tax rate on Bitcoin capital gains is 55%. So it makes the Japanese, you know, average Bitcoiner much more of a holder because they don't want to take that tax hit, right? Mm-hmm. And so again, the Japanese treasury company that's the biggest is Metaplanet. And that's a reason for that to be in demand because it's a, you know, you can participate in Bitcoin-related trading with only a 20% tax hit instead of 55. So uh-huh. that makes it, it's another reason to buy it.
Yeah. Definitely. And then, you know, I'm just kind of thinking about the sovereignty as well with Bitcoin, right? Like just mm-hmm. kind of holding it in cold storage, holding your private keys, and the way that it's, you know, not only the internet, but, you know, that Bitcoin has kind of revolutionized just people's lifestyles. Did you think, you know, when the early days that this would be kind of almost a catalyst to help people become, you know, this digital nomad, or did you think of it more of as a financial-based product?
Well, I mean, I was involved with some of the precursor to Bitcoin electronic cash projects. There mm-hmm. was one called DigiCash, which operated out of the Netherlands by David Chaum, who's a math, like cryptographer, math professor, and started a company. And, you know, myself and many people were very enthusiastic about this technology because it was bearer. It was very anonymous, and in effect unseizable, because even though the double spend database was centralized, they couldn't selectively freeze somebody because they didn't know who it was. You know, they couldn't track anything, right, by design. Now, you had the only way to get money in or out of that. I mean, you could transact the coins with privacy, but the only way to get money in was to transfer it with a bank in or out, right? So there was KYC around the edges, but not on the inside. And so, you know, I think Bitcoin provides that. And it is, to your point, interesting that having hard money seems to affect people's long-term thinking and planning. So they're much more incentivized to save for the future. They're inclined to reduce consumerist behavior. And, you know, once they start to think about the long term, they develop a different perspective. So now they think they have a personal, like, life planning exercise, which is 20 or 30 years in the future, where before it was maybe 6 months or something, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you need to save up because I want to spend money in a consumerist way in this way, and I need the deposit or something, right? So a lot of it depends on the culture. Some cultures are much more savings. But I think a lot of Western countries, you know, the savings rate is maybe 10 or 20%, whereas some countries it's the other way around. Like the savings rate is 80, 90%. So it's bringing this kind of savings culture to different group, a wider group of people, and in a much more strong way, because Bitcoin is a very aggressive savings technology because of the adoption curve. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, if you were doing this saving pre-Bitcoin, you know, you're saving so you can compound interest, which has a little effect that accumulates and compounds over, you know, a few decades. So it will work, but it's slow. Mm-hmm. With Bitcoin, you know, there's a guy in the Netherlands, I forgot his name, who sold his house and went all in Bitcoin. And, you know, you could see that worked in a spectacular way, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the concept that you could do something drastic like that, and it can completely change your finances. People see it, you know, they can recognize it because they can see that Bitcoin is, you know, 10 times what it was not very long ago. You know, so they might need to be in the market for a while to form a view that can continue and that they want to take that chance. But it does, the fact that it's got much more upside, plus, of course, risk and volatility, means that people are going to do more aggressive things to save money.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Adam, you were very generous with your time. I really appreciate you coming in and, you know, talking about all of these wide-ranging topics with me. Why don't you tell people where they can find out more about Blockstream and everything you've got going on?
Yeah, so if you go to blockstream.com or at Blockstream on Twitter or social media, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, awesome stuff. Well, thank you.
Thank you guys all for tuning in to another great episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you found some value in this one, please hit that subscribe button and that like button to help send this one to the masses. And I've got a surprise for you guys. I've got two more episodes that you have the chance to watch here. So go ahead and click one of them, and I'll see you guys all at the next one.